This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the April 11th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. I don't know if it has occurred to any of you, as it has to me, that allowing John Bolton to enter the White House as President Trump's national security advisor, as he did on Monday, may be akin to Nicholas Cruz being welcomed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, with a loaded AR-15, despite the local sheriff and the FBI having been warned a number of times that the young man was armed, dangerous, and threatening to kill. Like Cruz, Bolton is given fair warning of his plans in the mainstream media. An enthusiastic promoter of the war in Iraq, still considering it to have been the right thing for the U.S. to have done, he has written op-eds for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and told listeners to Fox News a number of occasions, where he has been a regular fixture, that the U.S. should bomb both North Korea and Iran, regardless of the consequences. While this has endeared him to the ultra-hawks and to Israel, and to mega-donor Sheldon Adelson in particular, it has frightened the more level-headed members of both the Democrat and Republican parties, who fear he will push the U.S. into another and more devastating war. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to examine the background of Mr. Bolton when I speak once again with award-winning investigative reporter Gareth Porter about his recent article in the American Conservative titled "The Untold Story of John Bolton's Campaign for War with Iran." Everybody knows Bolton's a hawk, is how Porter introduces his article. Less known is how he labored in secret to drive Washington and Tehran apart. That's what we'll be discussing at 20 minutes past the hour, along with the latest developments in the apparent U.S. plan to punish Iran and Syria for an alleged chlorine gas attack, so stay tuned. The Syrian war, like the election of Donald Trump, seems to have turned everything on its head, with the terms left and right and dove and hawk having become meaningless. Thus, we see Tucker Carlson on Fox News Monday being legitimately skeptical over whether Syria did indeed carry out the latest alleged chlorine gas attack on Douma, a suburb of Damascus, while Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept, speaking from Brazil on Democracy Now!, accepts as a fact that it did. Carlson pointed out that this past February 2nd, in an Associated Press story that got very little media exposure, Defense Secretary James Mattis admitted that the U.S. was unable to prove that the widely reported sarin gas attack last April on another opposition-held area in Syria was carried out by the Assad government or even involved sarin gas. Said Mattis 2 months ago, quote, "The U.S. has no evidence to confirm reports from aid groups and others that the Syrian government has used the deadly chemical sarin on its citizens," according to the AP story. "We have other reports in the battlefield from people who claim it's been used," Mattis told reporters at the Pentagon. "We do not have evidence of it," end quote. Mattis was not ruling out the possibility that it was sarin gas delivered by Syria, just that he had not seen any proof of it. That didn't stop Trump, however, from having the U.S. Navy launch 59 cruise missiles at the cost to taxpayers of $1 million each at the Syrian airbase from which the bombs allegedly containing the sarin had supposedly been fired. Mattis's admission did, for what it's worth, bolster the argument advanced by a number of international experts who disagree with the original sarin gas attribution. None, however, were given the time of day by any U.S. media to present their case to the American public. At the end of his Monday commentary, which you can find on YouTube, Carlson began an interview with Republican Senator Roger Swicker of Mississippi by asking the senator to explain why responding militarily to the allegations of a chlorine gas attack and risking a wider war in Syria was in America's national interest. "Well, if you care about Israel," the senator began, but Carlson wasn't buying it. But you can judge from Swicker's reply, who is pushing the U.S. into another Middle East war for Israel's benefit? The war in Syria has been one of competing propaganda from the beginning. Early on, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an unabashedly pro-Israel think tank launched by AIPAC in 1985, immediately adopted members of Syrian opposition groups and brought them to Washington to speak at seminars and meet members of Congress. In addition, it launched the FIKRA Forum, which the latter's Facebook page described as, quote, "an online community that aims to generate ideas to support Arab Democrats in their struggle with authoritarians and extremists." At the time of dramatic changes across the region, and notes, FICRA Forum is the first near real-time, fully translated Arabic-English blog to provide a two-way platform for those in the region seeking to shape the future of their countries and U.S.-based decision-makers and opinion leaders who are trying to understand and support those efforts, end quote. There is no indication on its page of its connection to the pro-Israel Washington Institute, but its connection to the events in Syria have been quite clear. A critical point raised by Tucker Carlson and other skeptics that the Syrian government was behind the latest attack was its timing. Carlson pointed out that the alleged sarin attack 2 years ago that General Mattis's February revelation undercut, and which led to the U.S. cruise missile barrage, occurred just after the U.S. had acknowledged that Bashar Assad was likely to remain as Syria's head of state. At that point, Carlson pointed out, with Syria clearly winning the war with Russian assistance, what reason would Assad have had for launching such an attack, one that was sure to result in worldwide condemnation? In the latest instance, it came just after the president announced he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. To no one's surprise, this was openly objected to by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as well as the usual array of hawks in Washington. Now, obviously, the troop withdrawal is not only not going to happen, we may be on the threshold of a new war depending on Washington's actions. But this is clearly what neither Syria nor its allies Russia and Iran would want. So there is every reason to suspect this is the latest attack has been a false flag operation, and if there was actually chlorine gas involved, it could have been supplied by an opposition group during a conventional attack, since opposition groups have demonstrated not only the ability to obtain or produce certain conventional weapons, but chemical weapons as well. Then there are competing videos. When the Syrian army retook East Ghouta, videos taken at the time, which you can still see online, showed the streets filled with people clearly celebrating amidst the scenes of destruction, some speaking about how they had been held hostage by the opposition groups that had forbidden them from leaving. Those videos, however, you did not see in any U.S. network news. Instead, we saw photos of empty buses lined up to take opposition fighters and their families to Idlib, and now civilian victims of what we were told was a chlorine gas attack. Most are children laid out on the floor, apparently dead, with obviously shocked civilians looking on. None appear to be acting in a horrible war that has no end. Who is responsible for their deaths is a question that remains to be answered. By an extraordinary coincidence, the latest events in Syria follow on the heels of a triumphal visit to the United States by a man who more than qualifies as a war criminal, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and future king of Saudi Arabia. With the invaluable assistance of the United States Air Force, begun under President Obama, bin Salman has been responsible for launching an unprovoked war against neighboring Yemen that has led to an extraordinary famine, killed tens of thousands of its people, and produced the worst epidemic of cholera in modern times. This seems to be of no concern to either party in Washington, as the Senate, with 10 Democrats joining Republicans, recently voted against even having a vote on ending the U.S. role in the war on Yemen, as noted by my last week's guest, Major Danny Sherson. Bin Salman, or MBS as he's referred to, made the cover of Time and is featured in a lengthy profile in the April 16th issue now on the newsstands, along with photos and miniature of him meeting with James Mattis, Christian Lagarde, Michael Bloomberg, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Branson. By the time he departs, Times Carl Vick writes, he will have visited 5 states, plus the District of Columbia, 4 presidents, 5 newspapers, unaccounted moguls, and Oprah. American hypocrisy been so shamelessly displayed. The reader must go well into the article before even arriving at the war on Yemen. Quote, in the name of standing up to Iran, Carl Vick writes, bin Salman launched a 2015 air war in Yemen that has cost more than 10,000 lives and devastated what was already the poorest country in the Arab world. Of the 16,749 bombing runs recorded since 2015 by the Yemen Data Project, an independent human rights monitoring group, nearly a third targeted non-military sites. The UN calls it, quote, the worst man-made humanitarian disaster of our time, end quote. I should note that journalists and other outside observers have said the figure of 10,000 dead, which never seems to change, is much higher. But unlike in Syria, the world and our politicians aren't paying attention. And as it was with the U.S. war in Iraq, there is no official tally of the dead. Their numbers do not include Saudis. Bin Salman told Time, while he does not rule out sending ground troops, his priority is that the war remain painless for his countrymen. Quote, we want to be assured that whatever happens, the Saudi people shouldn't feel it, he says. The economy shouldn't be harmed or even feel it. So we are trying to be sure we are far away from whatever escalation happens, end quote. The White House so far, notes Time's Carl Vick, is happy to play a supporting role in the Yemen war, providing intelligence, mid-air refueling, and billions of dollars in munitions. To illustrate the point, the last page of the seven-page article shows President Trump sitting with a grinning Ben Salman in the Oval Office, holding a large chart with photos of all the weapon systems the United States has sold to the Saudis that have enriched our arms manufacturers while enabling the monarchy to carry out a genocidal war on the people of Yemen. Across the top of the chart is a headline all in caps reading, $12.5 billion in finalized sales to Saudi Arabia, quote. Were there an honest caption underneath, it would cite Dr. Martin Luther King, as I and others did last week, who 50 years ago described the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And he might have added, there is no close second. By coincidence, the last time I spoke with Gareth Porter, my guest who will be on the air in a few minutes, the subject was the Russian anti-Russian hysteria that has permeated the liberal media and the statements of traditional anti-war Democrats in Congress who had bought into the still unproven allegations that Russians hacked the Democrats' emails. That day I traced it back to the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine in 2014, the evidence being a talk by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland to a Ukrainian-American association in which she boasted that the U.S. had spent $5 billion on regime change in Ukraine. And a secretly recorded conversation between Nuland and the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, to which she decided who would be the country's post-coup leader. I played both of these twice on Takes on the World. The latest fiasco seems to be the unproven allegation that Vladimir Putin personally ordered the assassination of a former Russian double agent and his daughter living in the British village of Salisbury, employing a deadly nerve gas agent. The alleged nerve gas agent, Novichok, they call it, which reportedly had been developed in the Soviet Union before its dissolution, but not produced, a key distinction, was supposed to have been applied to a doorknob at the former spy, Viktor Skripal, and his daughter, Lyulia, as well as a local policeman, had touched, and was so deadly, the public was told, that both father and daughter would not survive. Fortunately, it hasn't turned out that way. The daughter, Yulia, 33, has been released from the hospital, and her father, Sergei, 66, is making, quote, good progress and will be released from the hospital in due course. The policeman who also reportedly touched the doorknob was released from the hospital 3 weeks ago. Though the Tory Prime Minister, Theresa May, was quick to point an accusing finger directly at Putin and Britain's version of Donald Trump, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson claimed and still claims, without a shred of evidence, that the Russians have been working on this deadly nerve agent for a decade, Porton Down, British intelligence science laboratory, however said it was unable to determine the source of the agent, a not insignificant admission that the British government had discounted and the U.S. media ignored. On April 3rd, The Guardian reported, quote, British scientists at the Porton Down Defense Research Laboratory have not established that the nerve agent used to poison Sergei and Yulia Skripal was made in Russia. Gary Aikenhead, the chief executive of the government's Defense Science and Technology Laboratory, said the poison had been identified as a military-grade Novichok agent, which could probably be deployed only by a nation state. That's probably, not certainly. Large areas of central Salisbury have been cordoned off by police following the discovery of the Skripals ill on a park bench. Traces of NERS agent were supposedly found in a pub and restaurant where the pair had eaten, according to The Independent, leading authorities to warn that hundreds of people may have been put at risk of some exposure. Curiously, not a single Salisbury resident turned up sick, but the incident has created the worst political crisis between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War, not a small achievement by whoever was responsible. Well, in Gaza last Friday, for the second straight week, Palestinian residents of the besieged strip continued their march of return, symbolizing their efforts to claim what was guaranteed them under UN Resolution 194, passed in 1948, the right to return to their homeland, Palestine, in which their families were dispossessed in 1948. The number of marches was considerable, though not quite matching the estimated 30,000 of the initial week, in which at least 18 Palestinians were killed by pre-positioned Israeli snipers and at least another 1,500 wounded by live fire and rubber-coated bullets. Israeli sniper fire on Friday brought the number of Palestinian dead to at least 30, despite the efforts of Gazans to make targeting of individuals by Israelis more difficult by burning tires to create a smoke screen. Thanks to the internet, however, a new story involving an earlier Israeli shooting of a civilian in Gaza, which reveals the contempt with which Israeli soldiers in the government view Palestinian lives. On Monday, the Times of Israel reported that a video surfaced showing IDF sharpshooters this past December 22nd cheering as one of them shoots and fells a Palestinian who approached the Gaza security fence. The video, which clearly does not show the Palestinian approaching the fence, was widely shared online, apparently filmed through scope or binoculars. The soldiers can be heard discussing the shot as a sniper trains his rifle on the target, then the exploding of laughter and approval when the bullet hits the target. In the video, as the Times of Israel reports, the Palestinian was not armed and was not throwing rocks or firebombs at the security fence or Israeli troops on the other side. Israel's Education Minister Naftali Bennett and Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan defended the soldiers, claiming they were suffering from, quote, the stress of the battlefield, when in fact there was no battle and no battlefield. Yesterday, the Israeli army issued a statement saying the soldier who shot the Palestinian suspect behaved appropriately, but criticized the soldier who filmed and cheered the incident for violating military values. The army said the cameraman, who was not part of the unit serving on the border, would face disciplinary hearing and possibly criminal charges. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.